This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents The Darling Dahlias and the Unlucky Clover by Susan Wittig Albert. Narrated by Peggotty Price. October 1934. The Darling Dahlias Clubhouse and Gardens, 302 Camellia Street, Darling, Alabama. Dear reader, well, here we are again. Are you surprised? We'll bet dollars to donuts that you thought we wouldn't be back, and we were thinking along those same lines as well. Life in our little town has been pretty uneventful lately, which is exactly the way most of our folks like it, but it's not very interesting if you're looking for headlines. But then things took a turn for the worse. One of the men in Darling's wonderful Lucky Four Clovers barbershop quartet met with an unlucky accident not long before Darling played host to the Dixie Regional Barbershop Quartet competition. This tragic event threw a monkey wrench into the Clovers' hopes of winning the competition. While Sheriff Buddy Norris was able to get to the bottom of the situation, there are still some unanswered questions hanging on. We hope he gets those loose ends tied up soon. Mrs. Albert told us that she hadn't planned to write another book about us, but she changed her mind when she heard about the tragic mishap and its unfortunate aftermath. We're sorry to say, however, that not everybody in Darling is pleased to hear that she's added another book to our collection. Far be it from us to name names, but there are those who are afraid that her books may tarnish the reputation of our wonderful town, the way Miss Agatha Christie did with St. Mary Mead, which will forever be remembered as the unluckiest village in all England. Our Darling people are good as good can be, so don't you go thinking we aren't. We hope that Mrs. Albert will clear up this little problem somewhere in her story. In case this is the first time you've read a book about the Dahlias, we would like to tell you that our garden club is named for Mrs. Dahlia Blackstone, who generously gave us her beautiful house and gardens on Camellia Street, along with a vacant lot where we've planted a big vegetable garden. We know that flowers nourish the heart and soul, but a big plate of stewed okra with tomatoes, buttered corn on the cob, and potato salad go a long way to comfort a body, especially these days, when jobs don't grow on trees and money is scarce as hen's teeth. Every Dahlia agrees, if you've got a garden, you'll have all the wealth you need, and good health to boot. Now, let's see. Before you start reading, we have several messages to pass along. First, Mrs. Albert wants us to tell you that the title of her book refers to the four-leaf clover, as well as to that misfortunate member of Darling's famous barbershop quartet. But she asked us not to tell you which one, since that would spoil the story. Second, Miss Rogers, our Darling librarian, who wants everybody to use the correct names for plants, asks us to tell you that the Latin name of the four-leaf clover is trifolium. But some of us are very confused, since trifolium means three leaves, and the four-leaf clover has four, and sometimes five or six or even more. Anyway, in case Miss Rogers asks, please say we told you. Trifolium. And third, Aunt Hetty Little has asked us to pass along these heartening words from that well-known gardener and plant breeder, Luther Burbank. He said, "Flowers always make people better, happier, and more helpful. They are sunshine, food, and medicine to the mind." Mr. Burbank ought to know what he's talking about since he invented the Shasta daisy, which Miss Rogers says should properly be called the Leucanthemum ex superbum. When times get hard and days get dark, a few Leucanthemum ex superbum will go a long way toward making things better and happier and luckier for everybody, and especially for you. Well, you're probably anxious to start reading, so we won't hold you up any longer, but if you get tired of sitting with a book in your hand and want to get up and move around, you can go in the kitchen and bake a pie. Mrs. Albert says she has included a few recipes for you. And, of course, you have an invitation to join us in our garden. We can always find you some weeds to pull or a row to hoe. Sincerely yours, The Darling Dahlias. Chapter 1. The Lucky Four Clovers. Friday, October 12, 1934. I'm looking over a four-leaf clover I overlooked before. One leaf is sunshine, the second is rain, third is the roses that grow in the lane. No need explaining, the one remaining is somebody I adore. I'm looking over a four-leaf clover that I overlooked before. Lyrics by Mort Dixon, music by Harry M. Woods, 1927. It was raining cats and dogs on the evening of the show, but that didn't keep Darling from turning out in a big crowd, especially since the program was free. All the seats were taken in the basement meeting hall of the First Methodist Church, and Reverend Dooley, greeting folks at the door, was heard to mutter, "Should have sold tickets." Donations had been encouraged, though, and almost everybody contributed a store-bought can or quart jar of home-canned vegetables to the Darling Blessing Box, the contents of which would be distributed to folks who needed a little extra boost. Everybody always looked forward to the show put on each October by the Lucky Four Clovers, Darling's acclaimed men's barbershop group. During the much-anticipated evening, the Clovers would regale their fellow citizens and supporters with old-fashioned melodies, patriotic Confederate tunes, several spirituals, a few Broadway hits, and, of course, their signature song, "I'm Looking Over a Four-Leaf Clover," which they always sang at the beginning and end of the performance. It would be a splendid evening, one that the whole community enjoyed, for the Clovers seemed, in an odd sort of way, to belong to the community and to speak for it and represent it all at the same time. The Clovers sang from their hearts and from the heart of Darling, too. Clyde Clover had created the quartet back in 1917, the year Woodrow Wilson led the United States into the war to end all wars and dispatched the boys of the Alabama 167th to France. They were happy to go, of course. All red-blooded young Americans thought it was their duty to make the world safe for democracy. It might not have been quite what they were expecting, but they did it anyway, and bravely. All throughout the war, the Lucky Four Clovers kept Darling's patriotic spirits high. They sang, "Over There," and "Pack Up Your Troubles in Your Old Kit Bag," and "It's a Long, Long Way to Tipperary." The one wartime song they didn't sing was "I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy," because, of course, they weren't. And when the Great War ended and the numb and battle-scarred survivors came home, the Clovers celebrated their return, and the music seemed to promise a new beginning. They still sang the old favorites, of course, but the 20s were beginning to roar, and there was an avalanche of new music, bright and boisterous with the spirit of the age. They sang, "Ain't We Got Fun?" "Ma, He's Making Eyes at Me." "I'll See You in My Dreams." "Way Down Yonder in New Orleans." "Hard-Hearted Hannah," "The Vamp of Savannah." And naturally, "Alabama Bound." The decade's lively exuberance and boundless optimism was embodied in its music, and Darling, like everybody else in America, believed the party would go on forever. It didn't. The fun came to an end on Black Monday, 1929, when the markets crashed. The 30s didn't roar. They sighed and they sobbed, sometimes in minor keys. The favorites of those days, "Mood Indigo," "Willow Weep for Me," "Love Letters in the Sand," "Stormy Weather," were melancholy, but for all their sadness, they were sweetly melodic. And since almost every Darling family now had a radio, or a friendly neighbor who had a radio and was glad to offer an empty parlor chair, people spent their evenings listening. Everybody had a favorite show, the exotic foreign-sounding A&P Gypsies, sponsored by A&P Food Stores, the down-home Grand Ole Opry on Nashville's WSM with Dr. Humphrey Bates and his Possum Hunters, and the Binkley Brothers Dixie Clodhoppers, or the more sophisticated Palmolive Hour on Friday nights on NBC, where listeners could hear everything from opera to Broadway to jazz, sponsored by, of course, Palmolive Soap. Keep that schoolgirl complexion. People listened at night, hummed and whistled and sang the tunes during the day and played them, if they could, on their fiddles, guitars, ukuleles, auto harps, and the old Baldwin upright in the parlor. Because it was such a musical era, the Lucky Four Clovers were Darling's favorite sons. The quartet was invited to perform for school events, church socials, community dances, weddings, and even funerals, where they sang Just a Closer Walk with Thee and What a Friend We Have in Jesus, ending the service with Rock of Ages. When the Clovers were invited to sing, the grieving family was assured of a grand turnout of mourners and could be confident that there wouldn't be a dry eye in the house. Mr. Clover was dead by this time, and the membership of the quartet had changed, along with its repertoire. But the Clovers still performed their October show and always kept their audience completely enthralled. The 1934 fall show was special, for it was also a dress rehearsal before a live audience for the upcoming Dixie Regional Barbershop Quartet competition, which was scheduled to take place in the Darling Academy gym in just a couple of weeks. It was a wonderful opportunity for the homegrown Clovers, and all of Darling was wishing them luck. Ophelia Snow and Elizabeth Lacey, members and officers of the Darling Dahlia's Garden Club, had found seats together in the very first row. They were dressed in their Sunday best for the occasion. Ophelia in a pretty pink print silk with an ivory lace ruffle at the neck, and Liz in a blue silk crepe outfit with long sleeves, a stylish shawl collar, and a pleated skirt that came to well below the knee, a pleasure to wear after those short, skinny flapper dresses of a few years back, which had never been much of a hit in Darling.
"What a swell turnout," Ophelia said to Elizabeth.
She turned in her seat to peer at the crowd, which exuded the smell of wet wool, cigarette smoke, and blue waltz perfume.
"I do believe everybody in town must be here in spite of the rain. Looks like it's standing room only."
"Maybe Reverend Dooley can put some extra chairs up there by the stage," Lizzie said. Just as she said that, several young men came up the aisle carrying wooden folding chairs. With a clatter, they began setting them up on both sides of the platform at the front of the room. Ophelia leaned a little closer.
"I saw you and Mr. Mosley at the movie last weekend, Liz. State Fair it was. Do you have something to tell me?"
Lizzie turned to look curiously at her friend.
"Well, I guess I can tell you I like the movie.
Will Rogers is a favorite of mine. He can be funny without half trying. Janet Gaynor was great. I heard that some people were offended by the scene in the bedroom, but I didn't think it crossed the line. I mean, they were just talking."
Ophelia looked disappointed. "And that's it? You and Mr. Mosley aren't..."
She waggled her eyebrows.
"No, we are not," Lizzie was emphatic. "Benton Mosley is my boss, and he's a friend. If there's a movie we both like, sometimes we go together, but that's all it is, Opie, and all it's ever been. Nothing more."
Lizzie was fibbing just a little bit, for when she first went to work in Mr. Mosley's law office, she'd had a huge crush on him, and quite naturally so. He was intelligent, good-looking, and very kind to a young woman just starting out on her secretarial career, which, of course, she hadn't thought of as a career, not at the time, anyway. Her job was just a temporary stepping stone on the path that led every Darling girl to marriage, and marriage to Mr. Mosley, why, that would have been any Darling girl's dream. But that was years ago, and Lizzie had made a firm effort to put that girlish silliness behind her. To her mother's great despair, she no longer saw her job as a parking place while she went looking for a husband. She and Mr. Mosley had worked together for so long and so well that they could read each other's minds, and when they went out together for a social evening, it was comfortable, companionable fun. In the past few months, however, a rather unsettling difficulty had emerged in the office. The new CCC camp outside of town had been a welcome boost to Darling's economy, but it hadn't been much of a help for Mr. Mosley's law practice. Lizzie was beginning to fear that her job, which she needed, of course, to pay her bills, might not be as secure as she liked to believe. Last week, Mr. Mosley had even mentioned that he might have to cut her back to part-time.
Maybe 30 hours instead of 40,
he had said casually. Too casually, Lizzie thought, with a sinking feeling in the pit of her stomach. He was trying to act like 10 fewer hours a week didn't matter, but of course it did, to her pocketbook.
Nothing more, huh?
Ophelia repeated, sounding unconvinced.
Well, if you say so. But I still think that you and Mr. Mosley would make a really swell...
She broke off.
Oh, goody, here they come!
She sat up straight as 4 men emerged from a side door and stepped smartly onto the platform.
And don't they look fine?
Oh, they did. Dressed in dark suits, starched white shirts, and their usual bright green bow ties, the lucky 4 Clovers looked confident, self-assured, and eager to please their audience. For the last couple of years, the quartet had enjoyed a stable membership. Portly Martin Ewing, owner of Cypress County's biggest cotton gin, sang lead and acted as the group's amusing master of ceremonies. Frank Harwood, a salesman at the Kilgore Dodge dealership, a bachelor, and very good-looking, crooned a rich baritone. Reginald Dunlap, owner of Dunlap's Five and Dime, and the new husband of Liz Lacey's mother, sang a high, warbling tenor. And gray-haired Whitney Whitworth, the wealthy part-owner of the Darling Telephone Exchange, sang a full-throated bass but managed never to smile. Everybody settled back happily into their seats as the quartet swung into I'm Looking Over a Four-Leaf Clover. Then Mr. Ewing introduced himself and each of the other 3 men, although, of course, everybody in the room already knew who they were. He followed that with a few cheerful words about how lucky they all were to live in the beautiful town of Darling, the luckiest little town on earth, and then the songs began. The lucky 4 Clovers sang effortlessly, beautifully, with passion and precision, their voices blending harmoniously, and with no mistakes, not even one. They sang 5'2", Eyes of Blue, Has Anybody Seen My Girl? And Bye Bye Blackbird, and I Found a $1 Million Baby in a 5 and 10 cent store, and an old Stephen Foster ballad, Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair. They sang several familiar hymns and a few Broadway tunes and the Confederate songs that everyone in Darling loved, The Yellow Rose of Texas and The Battle Cry of Freedom, the Southern version, of course, and Dixie, with the audience joining in. And at the end of the performance, after the Clovers had reprised their signature song and taken their bows, everybody in the room jumped to their feet, clapping and shouting and whistling. 2 encores later, as Darlinians were putting up their umbrellas and sloshing back to their homes through the darkness and still pouring rain, they were saying that the Lucky 4 Clovers were the very best barbershop quartet in the entire South. Without a doubt, without a doubt, they would win the Dixie Championship and put Lucky Little Darling on the musical map. But while Darling folk are good and kind and industrious and have many outstanding talents, they are not very good at predicting the future. It isn't their fault, of course. It is fair to say that, as a species, humans are not very well equipped to look ahead. Nobody in the audience that night, for instance, could know that 2 of the Lucky 4 Clovers were destined to have some very bad luck very soon. One would lose his voice, and another would end up dead. Chapter 2. The Dahlias Plan Pies. Sunday, October 21st, 1934.
I swear, Bessie, Aunt Hetty Little said, in all my born days I have never seen a prettier pie pumpkin. Why, it makes my mouth water just to look at what's in that basket. I can picture the pies.
The bushel basket Aunt Hetty was looking at was filled with bright orange winter luxury pie pumpkins grown by the Darling Dahlias in the large vegetable garden next to their clubhouse. The basket in the middle of their clubhouse's kitchen floor was heaped with the small pumpkins, known across the South as the best pie pumpkin anybody could ever hope to grow.
And the Dahlia's canning kettle ladies, under the direction of Master Canner Bessie Bloodworth, were making sure that there would be plenty of pies this winter all over Darling.
"They do look good, don't they?" Bessie said proudly. "You know, Aunt Hetty, those seeds came from my mother's garden. She got them from her mother's garden in the mountains north of Tuscaloosa. Grandma bought a packet of winter luxury from the Johnson and Stokes seed catalog back when she set up housekeeping in 1895. Every year she saved the best seed, and my mother kept up the habit. So have I. That's been..."
She stopped, calculating.
"Why, almost 40 years now. 40 years.
Ophelia Snow, whose husband Jed owns Snow's Farm Supply, shook her head admiringly.
40 years worth of pumpkin pies from one packet of seeds? Why, that is just plain amazing, Bessie.
Mildred Kilgore turned from the kitchen counter where she was slipping the skins off steamed pumpkin halves and cutting the flesh into 1-inch cubes.
"How do you save the seeds, Bessie? I don't think I know how to do that."
Bessie, plumpish and short in her mid-50s, might have been tempted to roll her eyes, but she didn't, because Mildred was a friend, even if she wasn't much of a gardener.
"Why, there's nothing easier, Mildred."
She nodded toward a colander that was filled with pulp that Liz Lacey had scooped out of the pumpkins before she sliced them in half.
"You just stick that colander under the faucet and pick the biggest seeds out of that mess of fibers and stuff. Rinse them off clean and spread them out on a dish towel, separated as well as you can so they don't get all stuck together. Should take them about a week to dry. Then drop them into an envelope and write on it what they are with the date."
She smiled, reminiscently.
"It's a really nice feeling, you know, planting the same seed your mama and your grandma planted. Makes pumpkins feel like members of the family, in a way. Not to mention that you don't have to lay out good money for seeds every year," Aunt Hetty said, thoughtfully. "Although, maybe if Huey P. Long gets to the White House, we'll have a little more money in our pockets."
Everybody knew that Aunt Hetty had to cut corners where money was concerned and was hoping that Senator Long would win the 1936 presidential election. He was making a lot of noise about his Share the Wealth program, traveling around the country, promising that every family in America would get $2,000 a year. Not only that, but everyone over 60 would get a special $30 a month old age benefit. Some people were skeptical. "Where's that money going to come from is what I want to know." But others were in such dire straits that they were jumping at Huey Long's campaign promises like a rainbow trout jumping for a June bug. He was collecting quite a following.
"Franklin Roosevelt says he wants to give old folks a pension,"
Ophelia said, digging a pumpkin out of the basket.
"Well, then why hadn't he done something about it?" Aunt Hetty asked testily.
The oldest Dahlia, but still spry and alert, she read the newspapers and prided herself on keeping up with the political news. She answered her own question.
"He's afraid that if he does, people will say he's a socialist, so he's dragging his feet."
Bessie plunged her knife into a pumpkin and began sawing it in half.
"Old Huey P. says people can call him anything they want," she said, "as long as they listen to what he's got to say."
For years, Bessie had been a big fan of Senator Long, the former governor of Louisiana, who was telling everybody within earshot that he wanted rich folks to share their wealth, which meant that the government would take money from rich people and give it to the poor. It was a popular message, and whenever he went on the radio, Bessie and the ladies who lived in her Magnolia Manor boarding house gathered around the RCA and listened. Most of them clapped. Liz Lacey finished scooping the seeds out of a pumpkin Bessie had cut in half. Over her shoulder, she remarked mildly,
"Mr. Mosley says that kind of talk makes Senator Long a bigger socialist than FDR. He thinks the president is waiting for the right moment to push his Social Security plan through Congress. We just have to be patient a little while longer." "He'd better hurry," Ophelia said, "or he's going to disappoint a lot of people."
Agreeing, Lizzie turned back to her job, layering clean pumpkin halves into the big blue enamel pot. The pumpkins would steam on the back burner of the gas stove for 15 minutes or so. When they were cool enough to handle, Mildred could slip the skins right off.
If FDR does decide to push old age pensions, Bessie retorted, it'll be because Senator Long is nipping at his heels.
That's what Henry says, too, Erlynn Biddle replied, hanging the dish towel on the rack. Her husband Henry managed the Coca-Cola bottling plant outside of town.
He says Roosevelt is as good as far as he goes, but he doesn't go far enough.
If you ask me, he's gone way too far, Mildred said acidly. That man has been in office for only 18 months, and just look at all the programs he's come up with. The AAA and the CCC and the CWA and the FDIC and the FERA, crazy alphabet soup. Why, it's enough to make a person gag.
Mildred Kilgore and Roger, her husband, owned and managed Kilgore Motors, the local Dodge dealership, which hadn't exactly been doing a booming business during the Depression. It was hard to sell cars when people were worried about putting food on the table and shoes on the kids' feet. But the Kilgores had been staunch Hoover supporters, and Mildred had never gotten over his trouncing. She criticized FDR every chance she got. Bessie put down her knife.
Should I cut more pumpkins, or are we done for now?
Mildred surveyed what was in her bowl.
Looks like I've got enough for two more quarts, she said. That should fill up the pressure cooker.
How many quarts will that make total? Ophelia asked.
16, Mildred said.
She grinned.
That's 16 of Aunt Hetty's pumpkin pies, best in darling.
Erlynn began spooning the hot pumpkin cubes into sterilized quart mason jars.
Best pies in the world, she said.
The filled jars, capped with flat metal lids and shiny screw-on rings, would go into the club's new national pressure cooker, which the Dahlias had bought with the money they raised in their recent quilt raffle. After 90 minutes at 10 pounds pressure, the jars would be cooled. Some of them would go straight to the Darling Blessing box. Others would join the canned fruits and vegetables on the shelves in the clubhouse pantry.
Oh, yes, pies, exclaimed Liz, the current president of the Dahlias. That reminds me, girls, we need to make a plan for the community pie supper. It's a week from Friday after the Dixie Barbershop finals. The Dahlias have been asked to contribute a dozen pies.
She picked up a notepad and pencil from the table.
While I have you right here, maybe you can tell me what kind of pies you want to make.
The Dahlias were the most active club in town and were always being asked to contribute to this and that. The club was founded back in 1925 by that dedicated gardener, Mrs. Dahlia Blackstone, who bequeathed them her house at 302 Camellia Street, along with the dilapidated old house, now their clubhouse. Had come an acre of sadly run-down gardens in the back, a half-acre of overgrown vegetable garden in the adjoining lot, and two beautiful cucumber trees. They were really Magnolia acuminata, Miss Rogers reminded them. A librarian, she insisted that people use the proper names for things. Some might have been daunted by the condition of the gift, but that was when the Dahlias showed what they were made of. They repaired the roof and replaced the plumbing and then turned to the unkempt gardens. The front yard had once been filled with azaleas, roses, and hydrangeas, and the backyard, over an acre, swept down toward a little wooded area and a clear spring surrounded by bog iris, ferns, and pitcher plants. Inspired by the zeal that all true gardeners feel when they confront a weedy, overgrown garden, the eager Dahlias rolled up their sleeves, got out their gardening tools, and marched out into the jungle. They trimmed the clematis, mandevilla, and wisteria, cut back the exuberant Confederate jasmine and trumpet vine, and pruned the gardenias. They divided and replanted Mrs. Blackstone's favorite orange ditch lilies, as well as her crinum lilies, spider lilies, oxblood lilies, daffodils, and narcissus. Far too many to count. They pulled weeds and dug out invaders and cleared the curving perennial borders to give the larkspur phlox, Shasta daisies, iris, alliums, and asters more elbow room. They also pruned Mrs. Blackstone's many roses, the climbers, teas, ramblers, shrubs, and the rowdy, unruly ladybanks, whose arching green branches had taken over an entire corner, but whose gorgeous yellow blooms in early spring made it all worthwhile.
Then they hired Mr. Norris to bring Racer and plow the vegetable garden. Racer, his name was a darling joke, was as slow as blackstrap molasses in January, but the old bay gelding knew exactly what to do when he was hitched to the business end of a plow, and he and Mr. Norris whipped the garden plot into planting shape in almost no time. The dahlias got out their seeds and planted sweet corn, collards, chard, green beans, tomatoes, okra, mild bell peppers, and fiery chili peppers, eggplant, squash, melons, cucumbers, sweet potatoes, and, of course, pumpkins, both the large and jolly jack-o'-lantern pumpkins and Bessie's winter luxury pie pumpkins. In the natural way of things, and because they were very good gardeners, the garden had produced abundantly, yielding plenty of vegetables to sell at the Saturday farmers market and give away to the retirement haven, the old folks' home over on Rayburn Road, and to put up in mason jars like the delicious little pie pumpkins they were canning today.
"Pies for the pie supper," Aunt Hetty said thoughtfully. "Well, let's see. My big old pecan tree struggled this year, what with all the rain and hot weather we had in August and September. But there'll likely be enough for a real nice pecan pie or two."
She grinned mischievously.
"With my secret ingredient, of course."
Everybody laughed, for they knew her secret ingredient. Aunt Hetty's cousin, Rondell Little, lived back in the hills and made the very best brandy. Peach, apple, pear, cherry, whatever fruit he could get his hands on. Aunt Hetty used his brandy to flavor her pies. While prohibition was in effect, Rondell's brandy was illegal, so everybody just whispered about Aunt Hetty's secret ingredient. Now, almost a year after repeal, it was still illegal, since Cousin Rondell didn't have Alabama's tax stamp, so everybody still whispered.
"I'll take a couple of these pumpkins and make a pumpkin pie," Bessie offered. She smiled. "I'll make it with pineapple. It'll be a special treat."
"There are quite a few green tomatoes still left on the vines," Liz said. "Green tomato pie is always a hit, and it's easy. I'll make that." "Oh, and buttermilk pie," Ophelia added. "I'll make my mother's old-fashioned buttermilk pie."
"Put me down for lemon icebox pie," Mildred said. "Mrs. Hancock saved me some lemons when her grocery order came in the other day. I'll make a cookie crumb crust."
Liz grinned.
"Sounds like we have a plan, girls. Now, who'd like to call the other dahlias and ask them what they'll be bringing?"
Aunt Hetty peered at Liz over her silver-rimmed glasses.
"I would if I could, dear, but my party line is down."
"Again?" Mildred asked, raising her eyebrows. "Wasn't it down last week?"
"And the week before that,"
Aunt Hetty said with a scowl.
"I'm afraid it's getting to be a regular thing. There are six of us on that line, and we miss our morning coffee and conversation."
She looked pointedly at Ophelia.
"Claretta Manners is really stewing about it. She's writing a letter to the mayor. She says he ought to do something."
"I'm afraid Jed won't be any help," Ophelia said apologetically,
as she should, since her husband was Darling's mayor.
"Our line was out 3 days last week. He had some mayor's telephoning to do, and he was fit to be tied. He went over to the exchange and talked to Myra May about it. She says that we're having all these problems because Darling's outgrown the old switchboard. To fix the problem, we need a new one."
Myra May Mosswell and her friend Violet Sims, both active members of the Dahlias, owned and managed the Darling Telephone Exchange, which was located in the back room of the Darling Diner, which they also owned.
"Well, if that's what it is, I hope they do it soon," Aunt Hetty said emphatically. "I was one of the last to get on the telephone, but now that I've got used to having one, it's a tad bit hard to get along without it. I miss being in on the news as it happens."
Ophelia gave a regretful shake of her head.
"Myra May says the new switchboards work better and faster, but they're pretty expensive. She and Violet have just about half of what they need and are trying to get the other half from their partner. In the meantime, we just have to get along the best we can."
"Partner?" Bessie asked curiously. I didn't know they had a partner. Who is it?
Mildred lifted her chin. Myra May just needs to get creative, she said in a teacherly tone. If she put her mind to it, I'm sure she could come up with a solution.
There was a silence.
Everybody knew that Mildred was thinking of events at Kilgore Motors, which had almost gone out of business over some mistakes her husband Roger had made, mistakes she would never let the poor man live down. But while Mildred carried a grudge longer than most, she was a creative manager who would try anything to boost sales. With that in mind, she had hired Frank Harwood as a salesman and posted a big sign in the window. Buy a new car and get 10 free driving lessons.
The fact that Mr. Harwood, the driving teacher, looked and sounded like Rudy Valley didn't hurt a thing, of course. He even had a bit of the crooner's silver-tongued, intimate style. Darlene's matrons were smitten, just as Mildred had hoped they would be. In fact, one of the more affluent women in town had persuaded her husband to purchase a new car, and another had bought one for herself.
"Well, my phone is working," Liz said. "At least it was this morning, and if it isn't, I'm sure Mr. Mosley won't mind if I use the office phone. How about if I make the calls?"
"If you don't mind, Liz," Aunt Hetty said.
"I'll take half of them," Bessie offered. "I'm sure I can find a time when my phone is working."
And that was how they settled it. The Dahlias can always come up with a plan, especially when pies are involved.
Chapter 3. Ophelia, Girl Reporter. Monday, October 22nd. Ophelia took off her pink sweater and hung it on the wall beside her desk at the Darling Dispatch.
"It's warm for October," she remarked brightly. "Bet it hits 80 today."
Charlie Dickens, the editor of the Dispatch, glanced at the clock, which said 8:30.
"Running a little late, aren't you?"
He went back to his two-finger attack on his royal typewriter. Ophelia sighed. It was hard to be a wife and mother and a working girl all at the same time, especially when the working girl part of you held down not one, but two jobs.
"I would have called," she said apologetically, "but my phone was out."
Charlie stopped typing.
"Again?"
he asked in the skeptical tone of a schoolteacher asking why the homework was late.
"Yes, again," she said. "Myra May says Darlene has outgrown the switchboard. We need a new one."
Defensively, she added,
"Actually, I'm late because Jed had to have a starched white shirt for a meeting."
She doubted that her excuse would hold any water with Charlie, though. The man had never ironed a starched white dress shirt in his life. He had no idea how much fussing it took. And since Ophelia had long since had to let her maid go, she was the one who did the fussing. But her remark got his attention. He stopped pecking and reached for the open pack of Camels on his desk.
"What meeting?"
Ophelia knew why he was asking. It was true that her husband was the mayor of Darling, but he was also the proprietor of Snow's Farm Supply and a blue plaid shirt and no necktie kind of guy. Jed only wore a starched white shirt to church and somebody's funeral, which meant that since this wasn't Sunday or a revival meeting day and nobody had died, something rather unusual must be going on.
"The Share the Wealth Society," she replied. "They're having a brown bag lunch in the back room at Musgrove's Hardware. They're meeting every Monday now. Jed always goes."
Actually, Ophelia thought that she should be the one attending the meeting since she was the one who shared most of the wealth in the Snow family. On Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, she was a reporter, advertising manager, and linotype operator for the newspaper, a job she'd had for several years. Last spring, she had been hired to work in the commandant's office at the nearby CCC camp on Tuesdays and Fridays, which meant a little more money coming into the family coffers. Ophelia's two paychecks were as welcome as a cooling rain on a scorching July day, especially because the children, 17-year-old Sam and 15-year-old Sarah,
always needed school clothes and supplies. The elder Snows, Jed's parents, needed help with the doctor and dentist bills. Ophelia couldn't begin to imagine how the six of them would get along without her money. But however welcome it was, Ophelia's income was also a touchy subject at the Snow House. Since the crash, farmers couldn't afford to buy much feed or equipment, so Snow's farm supply was barely able to pay its owner a salary, no matter how many hours a week he worked. Jed knew they needed Ophelia's money, but he didn't appreciate being reminded that his wife brought in more than he did. And even worse, one of her jobs took her out to the CCC camp, where she worked with dozens of strange men, with damn Yankees, and all of them in uniform, while Jed's heart belonged to Dixie. Altogether, it was a bitter pill for him to swallow. But Ophelia knew that wasn't the only reason why Jed hadn't invited her to the meeting. The Share the Wealth Society was made up exclusively of men. Women weren't allowed. Huh. Charlie scraped a wood match with his thumbnail and lit his cigarette.
So your husband has decided to cast his lot with Huey P.
His tone was sarcastic.
What makes him think there'll be any more wealth to share if Long makes it into the White House?
I don't know that he does, really, Ophelia said. She pulled out her chair and sat down at her desk, frowning. It sounded like Charlie had got up on the wrong side of the bed this morning, which was unusual these days. He had been a bear to work with before he and Fanny Champagne got married and settled into her apartment over the hat shop. But Fanny had worked miracles, and the grumpy old grizzly had turned into something closer to a well-mannered lamb. Tentatively, she added, "What's so bad about Senator Long, anyway?" Charlie blew out the match. He countered with,
"Why does Jed have to wear a white shirt?"
"Because prosperous men wear white shirts and ties," Ophelia said, taking the cover off her typewriter.
Jed had explained this in detail.
"Because Share the Wealth folks believe in dressing for success. If you dress like you're successful, you're more likely to be successful."
The men, anyway. She wondered what women wore when they dressed for success. "Ha!" she thought to herself, looking down at her pink and green cotton print dress, which she had sewn herself out of some yard goods she'd bought on sale at Man's Mercantile for 12 cents a yard. As if a woman would ever be able to dress for success. She turned to Charlie and asked again,
"What's so bad about Senator Long?"
Charlie peered at her over his round, wire-rimmed spectacles.
"You really don't know, do you?"
It wasn't a question.
"If I knew, I wouldn't be asking," she retorted.
But she supposed she did know. Huey P. Long, familiarly known as the Kingfish, after a character on the Amos and Andy radio program, had been constantly in the news since the day he was elected as Louisiana's governor and started riling people up. Now he was a senator and a Democrat, like President Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was also what people called a populist. He and FDR were poles apart, politically speaking. As Jed put it, Long and the president were as different as chalk and cheese. Since Roosevelt had settled in the White House the previous year and began pushing the New Deal, he had made a lot of changes to repair the damage done when the stock market plunged into oblivion. Some of the changes were welcome, like the repeal of Prohibition and the creation of the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was already creating work for thousands of unemployed young men. Others were controversial, like relief, which everybody hated, even the people who needed it, and plowing up the cotton so it wasn't a glut on the market. Still, after 4 years of Herbert Hoover sitting on his thumbs, it was a relief to have a president who rolled up his sleeves and actually did something. As Will Rogers said on his Sunday Night Gulf Headliners radio show, it didn't much matter what FDR did.
"If he burned down the Capitol," Rogers had said, "we'd all cheer and say, at least he got a fire started."
But the Kingfish and his followers thought that the president ought to start a bigger fire, especially when it came to helping poor folks, who were about 9/10 of the population.
Senator Long was gearing up for a run at the White House in the 1936 election, and there were plenty of people in Darling who thought he had a very good chance. Charlie Dickens, on the other hand, was an FDR supporter, so naturally he didn't much like the senator, which was why he called him Huey P. in that sarcastic tone of voice. Now, answering Ophelia's question, Charlie pursed his lips.
I guess you've never heard that Roosevelt called Huey Long one of the two most dangerous men in the country.
No, I've never heard that, Ophelia said, surprised. Why in the world would he say a thing like that?
Because Huey makes promises he can't keep, Charlie said. Folks need hope, and that's what he gives them in spades. He gets them all riled up, promising he'll give them everything they want. Jobs, money, better housing, better schools, like this every man's a king slogan of his, and his plan to take money away from the rich to give to the poor. But even if he gets elected president, Long won't be able to deliver. People will be mad as hell and take to the streets. Roosevelt is afraid of a revolution.
Ophelia thought about this for a moment. Reluctantly, she supposed there was something to it, although when Huey P. was governor of Louisiana, he had delivered a lot of roads and schools. Of course, quite a few of his cronies had gotten rich in the process, but she supposed that was the way these things worked. People in government thought they had to take care of their friends or they wouldn't have any. She frowned. Who's the other? Charlie pushed his glasses up on his nose.
The other what?
The other most dangerous man.
Ah, him. General Douglas MacArthur.
Oh, Ophelia said. Then humbly, I guess I don't understand.
You don't remember when the Bonus Army was camping out in Washington, the summer of 32? MacArthur ordered the cavalry and 6 tanks to charge on them. Those poor souls were veterans, just wanting the government to pay them the bonus they were due from the Great War.
Oh, Ophelia said again, remembering. I guess somebody like that couldn't be a very good general, could he?
Right.
Charlie went back to his rapid-fire 2-finger typing for a moment, then stopped regarding her.
I don't suppose you'd like to go to that meeting. Share the wealth, I mean.
Of course I would, Ophelia said, but I can't. She wrinkled her nose. Jed says it's just men.
Oh, yeah,
Charlie chuckled sarcastically.
I forgot. Every man is a king. Huey P. doesn't say anything about women, does he? But you can go as a reporter, if you want to. Take notes, write up a story for next week's dispatch.
Gosh, that would be swell, Ophelia said excitedly. Thank you, Charlie. She had been stuck with Darling's Women's News, the Mother's Guild, the Quilting Society, the Dahlias for way too long. She was eager to sink her teeth into some real reporting. Share the Wealth would be a great place to start. Charlie held up a finger.
One caveat, he said. I'm not going to run a story about how wonderful Huey P. is and what he's promising to do to help all us poor folks improve our lot in life. There's enough of that stuff out there. What I want is a story about the men in the Share the Wealth Society, why they joined, what they're afraid of, what they want to see happen here in Darling that they're not seeing now. Individual stories about real people, human interest stories, why it matters stories.
He cocked an eyebrow.
You think you might be able to handle that assignment, Ophelia?
I can try. Ophelia said, a little doubtfully.
Do it,
Charlie said and went back to his typing. Ophelia stole a glance at her boss. His green celluloid eye shade was pulled low and his cigarette dangled from one corner of his mouth the way it always did, the smoke curling in front of his face. As usual, his wire-rimmed glasses were perched on the end of his nose. His shirt sleeves were rolled to his elbows, and his gray vest hung open to reveal a loosely knotted tie. But she thought his face was a little grayer, his shoulders a little more slumped, and he didn't seem to be attacking his typewriter with his usual ferocity. Ophelia wondered why. Now that the CCC camp was in full swing and spending several thousands of dollars a month in Cypress County, advertising and subscriptions were both back up, and the Dispatch was on a sure footing. Charlie ought to be in a better mood. But maybe there was something wrong with the newspaper's equipment, always a possibility since, as Charlie frequently said, it was older than dirt. She turned to look at the black Babcock cylinder press, a hulking four-pager that shook the floors and rattled the windows when it was chugging along at top speed on Thursday nights, when Charlie ran the home print pages. It looked the same as always, and so did her linotype machine, a pre-war monster that she operated easily, even though women were not supposed to be strong enough to pull that heavy lever. The small Miles proofing press sat on the table beside the linotype. Against the other wall stood the marble-top tables where the pages were made up, the printer's cabinets with their drawers full of type fonts, and the stacks of paper press-ready. And the smaller job press, on which Charlie printed the flyers and invoices and business forms that filled in the income gaps as newspaper ad revenue, waxed and waned. But nothing looked amiss, and she turned back, sneaking a sidelong glance at Charlie. Yes, he definitely didn't look as chipper as he had since he and Fanny were married. Maybe something was wrong at home, now that the honeymoon was over and the two of them had to learn to live together, a challenge in any marriage, as she herself had to admit. But if that's what it was, she reminded herself sternly it was none of her business. Jed was always warning her against sticking her nose where it didn't belong. "Do it once too often, and somebody will smack you right in the kisser," he said, and she thought he was probably right. So instead of asking Charlie if everything was all right at home, she took out her steno pad and flipped through the pages until she found the notes she had taken at the meeting of the Ladies' Guild in the Baptist Church basement the week before. Then she rolled a long column-width strip of paper into the old black Underwood she had bought for $1.50 at Mr. Wheeler's yard sale and began to type. The machine was still a little stiff, even after her son Sam had cleaned it up and oiled it, but it wasn't long before her fingers were flying. And this story was actually fun to write. The Ladies' Guild had held its annual rummage sale on the Baptist Church lawn, where they had sold children's clothes, shoes, dishes, books, and tools, raising a grand total of $42.35, almost a record, the organizers said. The entire amount would go toward buying groceries for the Darling Blessing Box. Ophelia typed -30- at the end of the story and pulled it out of her typewriter. Charity, she thought happily, didn't have to be doled out by the federal government in Washington, D.C. There were plenty of ways to share the wealth right here at home, and she had a new assignment. She was going to that meeting after all, as a reporter. Chapter 4. Charlie Dickens Gets a Tip. Charlie was working on the lead story for Friday's Dispatch about Boomer Bronson falling off the roof of Claude Peavy's barn without killing himself, thankfully, although how thankful you were depended on what you thought about Boomer, Charlie reckoned. That Boomer was drunk as a skunk on Bodine Pyle's White Lightning probably figured heavily in his survival, although that wasn't the kind of detail that Charlie would include in the Dispatch. Nor could he include the fact that this happened at midnight, and that Claude was up there on the roof with Boomer, both of them naked as jaybirds. Or that when they were found by Mrs. Peavy, they were lying on their backs on a pile of hay, yodeling to the moon. Or what Mrs. Peavy might have said, or might have been imagined to say, when she came upon the scene. Without these interesting details, Boomer's tumble wasn't much of a story, which was a sad thing, but nothing new. Once upon a time, Charlie had written feature stories for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and the Baltimore Sun, undercover stories, investigative stories, in-depth, tell-it-all stories, that told readers what they didn't know. He had dug up the dirt on local politicians, blown the whistle on some notorious police corruption, and triggered a federal investigation that ended with a major league crime boss going to jail. He had been read, applauded, rewarded, and even fired a time or two. He had been good. He had been damn good. That was then. This was now. While Charlie had scored several big stories in the Dispatch, the killing of Ryder Ledoux by the Federal Revenue Agents at Mickey Ledoux's still on Dead Cow Creek, the embezzlement scheme at the CCC camp, and the sensational murder of the 11 o'clock lady, there had not been one single shred of news worth reporting in the past few months. Boomer's story, unfortunately, was more notable for the parts that couldn't be printed in the paper. And the only news on the horizon was the barbershop quartet competition being held in town next week. There certainly wasn't much excitement in that, just a bunch of guys singing close harmony on the stage at the Academy with a big community pie supper afterward. Of course, if the Lucky Four Clovers were lucky enough to win, there might be a nice story in that. Local interest, anyway, with a focus on each of the four men. If they won. People said they were good, but Charlie wasn't enough of a music fan to know whether the hometown team stood even half a chance. With an ironic twist of his mouth, Charlie pulled Boomer's story out of his typewriter and dropped it into the wooden tray on his desk, one of a stack of wooden letter trays labeled page 1, 2, 3, and 4. They were the same trays his father had used for the very same purpose back in the day when he edited and published the Dispatch. That was before the senior Charles Dickens succumbed to lung cancer and left the newspaper to his only son. Charlie, himself a newsman, had figured to sell it quick, pocket the change, and go back to his old job of crime reporter for the Plain Dealer. But after the stock market took its fatal nosedive, the Plain Dealer, and every newspaper everywhere, stopped hiring. Worse, nobody wanted to buy a newspaper with a shrinking subscription list, declining advertising revenue, and a faltering job printing business, in a two-bit southern town where a halfway decent story came along once in a blue moon. His father's pride and joy was an albatross around Charlie's neck. Well, the Boomer story, inconsequential as it was, filled out the rest of the page. In a couple of hours, Ophelia would take his stories and hers to the linotype machine and begin setting up the four pages of what they called home print, the local news, the church and club news, births, deaths, marriages, and travel, mostly weekend visits to family on the other side of the county. There was also Liz Lacey's Garden Gate column and whatever local ads Ophelia had been able to sell. That part of the job had to be finished in time to get the pages on the press late Thursday night. On Friday, the home print pages would then be folded together with the four pages of ready print that Charlie bought from a syndicate called the Western Newspaper Union, as did the hundreds of other little newspapers around the country. The ready print pages contained the national and international news, mostly dismal these days, the financial news, still disastrous, the women's column, twaddle, serialized fiction, trash, comics, and sports, although this year's World Series would make it to the national page with good reason. The St. Louis Cardinals had just squeaked past the Detroit Tigers 4-3, with pitching brothers Dizzy and Daffy Dean each winning 2 games for the Gas House Gang. They were still dancing in St. Louis, where after the game, August Bush's new team of Clydesdales had paraded around the infield, pulling a shiny red beer wagon loaded with free bottles of Bud. This was the first wet series since the 31st of July, 1919, when the National Wartime Prohibition Act had thrown 3 strikes at the beer industry. In fact, the ready print ought to be loaded with news this week. Over in Germany, they were still talking about the extravagant Nuremberg rally the Nazis had staged for their man Hitler, whom they were now calling their Führer. Back home, investigators were still trying to figure out the cause of the fire that destroyed the Morrow Castle, leaving 137 passengers and crew dead. The latest cost of living figures were out. The average cost of a new house, if you could afford one, was $5,970. But if you were renting, you could figure on spending an average of $240 a year out of your average annual wage of $1,600. And there had been 3 more kidnappings in the past 7 days. A plague of kidnappers had settled on the land, it seemed, snatching anybody whose family might be willing to pay a ransom. With any luck, the bundles of ready print would arrive from Mobile on the Thursday afternoon Greyhound bus, although that depended on whether the bus, which was no spring chicken, made the trip without breaking down.